Thank you, Richard. Well, can we turn, please, to that passage in 2 John that was read earlier? Nice to be here again. It's always good to come back to my home church that I first came to when I was 3 years of age, to Sunday school here, and many a Sunday evening at 6:30 as a teenager, when there used to be about two rows right at the back, and that was all there was. And I remember once there was such a huge gap between the preacher and the two rows at the back, and I was a sort of angry young man in those days. I just grabbed the lectern and walked up the aisle with it and stood it in front of the two back rows, and one of the elders nearly died. He was so shocked. 2 John verses 7 to 13. Do you know, I've never preached on this passage before. I mean, you've been going on about how many sermons I've preached, and that's right, I don't know how many I've preached, but I've never actually preached on this passage before in my whole life. So thank you very much for giving me this passage to speak on. It's actually a subject that it would be nice not to have to speak on. It would be great if we didn't have to speak about it. I mean, have you ever thought, wouldn't it be great, wouldn't it be nice if everyone who was sort of enthusiastic about Jesus could just get together and unite and just agree? Wouldn't that be a great witness to the world? I mean, there's tremendous opposition to the church, growing opposition in our own country. Why don't we just get together with anybody who seems to be enthusiastic about Jesus? Well, this passage tonight tells us that it's sadly not quite as straightforward as that. This passage here tonight tells us that there are people who are enthusiastic about Jesus who are not helpful to us at all. There are people who are enthusiastic about Jesus who are actually dangerous. People who lead Christians astray and who will ruin our Christian lives. John talks about losing, verse 8, what we've worked for. Watch out that you do not lose what you've worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. If you're the sort of person who believes you can lose your salvation, you could make that one of your proof texts if you want to. If, like me, you don't think a true Christian can lose their salvation, you would say, as I believe, that John is saying that it is possible to lose your reward, all you've worked for. Think of all the work that's gone into the church here over the years. It could be lost, just like that, says John. Because of some people, some dangerous people. And the New Testament actually warns us over and over again about people like this. And he tells us to look out for them. We are to beware. We are to have our wits about us. We are not to be taken in. So actually, one of the worst things we could do, according to the New Testament, is to drop our guard and just welcome everyone who claims to be enthusiastic about Jesus. John says here that there are deceivers. That's the word he uses, deceivers out there, verse 7. Many deceivers. Now the thing about a deceiver is that he's not obvious. A deceiver doesn't come into church wearing a badge saying deceiver, or false teacher, or false prophet. I mean, it would be very helpful if they did, but they don't. These people actually look like Christians, and they pretend to be Christians, and some of them think they are Christians, but they're not. And it's not just John who tells us to watch out for people like this. Jesus says that many false prophets have gone out into the world. Many. And in fact, the word many here is here as well. Verse 7, many deceivers. So a deceiver or a false prophet isn't somebody you might just possibly meet once or twice in a lifetime. There are many deceivers out there. There are many false prophets out there. And Jesus called these false prophets wolves in sheep's clothing. Now, what could be more dangerous than a wolf in sheep's clothing? Wolves tear sheep apart. And it is the instinctive reaction of the sheep to flee from a wolf. But what if the wolf looks like a sheep? What if he's dressed up to look exactly like a sheep? What could be more dangerous than a wolf that looks like a sheep? It's not just Jesus who tells us about false prophets who will destroy the sheep. When Paul gave his farewell address to the elders at Ephesus, where he spent 3 years preaching and teaching, this is what he said to the elders at Ephesus. He says, I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock, even from your own number. You elders at Ephesus, even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard. Peter says exactly the same thing in his second letter, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. There were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. He takes it for granted. He doesn't say this might happen. He says it's going to happen. It will happen. There will be false teachers among you, he says. Among you. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. And Paul's letters to Timothy and Titus tell us that one of the qualifications for church leaders, one of the qualifications for elders, is that they teach sound doctrine, that they encourage people through sound, and that word just means healthy, doctrine that makes you strong and fit. One of the qualifications for elders is that they teach sound doctrine and that they refute those who oppose sound doctrine. Titus chapter 1, verse 6, where we have a list of qualifications for elders. One of them, an elder, chapter 1, verse 9, he must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that he can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. So an elder must be able to recognize false teaching. And he must be able to show the people that he's responsible for why it's false teaching, why it's wrong. He must be able to refute it. And so John here agrees with Jesus, he agrees with Paul, he agrees with Peter, and he says, many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ have gone out into the world. He said exactly the same thing in his first letter. Now he says, any such person like this, deceivers who do not really acknowledge Jesus Christ, the Jesus Christ of the New Testament, they don't acknowledge that Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. They are, he says, antichrist. Verse 7. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Now, some of us here will have been brought up to think of the antichrist as a figure who will arise at the end time. Some kind of world ruler who will persecute the church in the last days. So if you're not around in the last days, well, the Antichrist is a bit irrelevant. But that's not John's view of the Antichrist. And in fact, John is the only person who uses this word Antichrist. And John, both in this passage and in his first letter, says that the Antichrist is already here. And the spirit of Antichrist is already in the world, and it takes many, many forms. Many Antichrists have gone out into the world. So the Antichrist isn't some distant figure that we can have fun trying to identify. There are many of them already who have gone out into the world. Don't waste your time trying to work out what 666 means. The Antichrist may be in your church. He may be in your pulpit. John is saying, here. So this is pretty serious, isn't it? John is saying here that there will be people who will infiltrate Christian churches. They will not obviously be non-Christians. They will give the appearance of being committed to Christ, but they are actually as far from the real thing as you could get. They are dangerous antichrists. John says we should expect such people, we should look out for them, and church leaders should be able to identify them and refute them. And sheep should run away from wolves. We shouldn't drop our differences with wolves. Sheep shouldn't drop their differences with wolves and form a nice little sheep-stroke-wolf fellowship. It's not going to work. The wolves will win every time. Happy fellowship between sheep and wolves. Doesn't work. Okay, so that's the first point. There are deceivers out there. Secondly, what were these deceivers teaching? There were two forms of false teaching that threatened the New Testament churches. The earliest form of false teaching which threatened the churches was very, very Jewish. It wasn't long before Gentiles started getting converted and being brought into the church through faith in Jesus Christ. And the church, of course, was completely Jewish to begin with. And some very conservative Jewish Christians said, if Gentiles are going to be saved, they've not just got to become Christians, they've got to become Jews. They've not just got to believe in Jesus and be committed to Jesus, they've got to be committed to Moses. So it's Jesus plus Moses. And only then will Gentiles be acceptable to God and acceptable to the church. In other words, Jesus' work on the cross isn't enough. Well, Paul dealt with that. He knocked that one on the head. Just read Galatians. But there was another false teaching that threatened the early churches. It came along a bit later. We can't be certain about all the details, but we do know a little bit about the early heresies of the second century, particularly in this area of Ephesus, the Roman province of Asia, that John lived in and wrote these letters from. And many scholars think that these heresies became what was known later on as Gnosticism. And what were they teaching? Well, they were teaching this. The basic idea was that the material world, the physical world, was evil. Spirit is good, matter is evil. Some of them even taught that the material creation was created by a less spiritual divine being. So human beings are good spirits trapped in evil bodies. And the sooner we're away from the body, like a canary out of its cage, the better. Now, why did they teach this? Well, because many philosophies and many religions of the time took this view, that the material world was evil and the spirit was good. It was a very popular view in the Eastern religions and in many of the philosophies of the day. And they wanted to be relevant. And so they tried to fit the gospel into the thinking of the day, the world view of the day. So what did they end up with? Well, they ended up by saying that God couldn't possibly have become flesh. Christ couldn't possibly have become flesh, because flesh is sinful. Flesh is evil. In other words, God could not have become a real human being. Some of them thought that Jesus was a spirit who appeared to be a human being. He sort of took on a human form, but he wasn't really human. Others of them said that Jesus was a spirit, that Christ was a spirit that inhabited the human being Jesus for a while. He came onto him at his baptism, and some of them thought that he left him at the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? So for a while, this man Jesus was inhabited by a completely spiritual Christ. And the point of Jesus coming to us was not to save us or to redeem us from sin. It was to enlighten us, to show us who we really are in our spirit. And of course, these people denied the resurrection of the body. If the body is evil, who wants a resurrection body? The sooner we're away from the body and become disembodied spirits, the better, according to this view. And that's actually the view of some Christians these days as well. But it's completely unbiblical. It's completely wrong. How did they come to the conclusions like this? So obviously wrong. Well, they tried to fit the gospel into the worldview of the day, which was that the material world was evil and spirit was good. And whenever you do that, whenever you try and fit the gospel into the worldview of the day, you end up with a gospel that isn't a gospel. Let me give you some examples. What are some of the philosophies of the day? What are some of the worldviews in our society? Well, scientism. Scientism is the view that everything has to be explained by science. There's only the material world, that's all there is. And the material world is discoverable, potentially discoverable and understandable by the techniques of science. And if it's not open to scientific investigation, it's not real, it's not true. What happens when you try and force the gospel into that view? Well, you end up by throwing out everything that science can't explain. You end up with a gospel with no miracles. You end up with a Jesus who wasn't born of a virgin, who didn't rise from the dead bodily. There was a well-known bishop, 20, 25 years ago, Bishop of Durham, 20, 25 years ago, who openly denied the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. You ended up with liberal theology like that. A gospel with no miracle. It emptied our churches. Liberal theology. Another popular view of the day is what we call pluralism. Pluralism is the view that truth is too big for anybody to take in. And therefore everybody's angle on the truth must be accepted. If it's true for you, it's okay, it's true. If it's true for you, if it helps you, it's true for you. And therefore we've got to accept and respect everybody's view, particularly about religion, because religion, God, if he's there, is far too big for anybody, any of us, any one person or any one religion to understand. What happens when you try and fit the gospel into that worldview? Well, you get the view that all religions lead to God. All religions are basically the same. They're all different paths up the same mountain. They all get to the top in the end. Another worldview of our day is selfism, self-esteem, self-expression, freedom to be myself. What happens when you try and fit the gospel into that view? Well, you have to do away with sin and guilt. You have to do away with self-denial. These are the worst things that can happen in our society. The idea of sin, the idea of denying yourself and not being yourself. And then another popular view today is consumerism. People think, because of this emphasis on the self and freedom, that there's got to be a host of things to choose. And the result is consumerism, and when consumerism hits the church, then you get Christians who think that the church is there just to meet their needs. Just like the local supermarket. And they move from one church to another, seeking the best deal. And they change churches like some people change supermarkets. They're never committed to a particular church for a lifetime. That's how churches grow, through people who are committed to that church for a lifetime, if they're there all their lives. Not by people who move from one church to another trying to find the best deal. That's just a few examples of how we are influenced, whether we like it or not, by the worldviews of our day. And when we try and fit the Word of God into the worldviews of our day, or the Gospel into the worldviews of our day, we end up with a Gospel that is different from the Gospel in the New Testament. Okay, so that's what these people were teaching. Thirdly, and my last two points are shorter than the first two, you'll be glad to know. Thirdly, how do we respond to false teachers? John makes two points, one's positive and the other's negative. The positive one is in verse 9. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. So how do we respond to false teaching? How do we respond to deceivers? Twice John uses this expression, continue in the teaching. Continue in the teaching. What does he mean by the teaching? He means the teaching he had given them as an apostle of Jesus Christ. Now he makes this point, we haven't time to look the references up, but he makes this point again and again in 1 John, which is a much longer version of 2 John. He makes some of the same points. He says, continue in the teaching. Jesus chose apostles to be his authentic teachers. And Paul makes exactly the point to Timothy and Titus. He says, guard the gospel, guard the deposit, guard the teaching that I passed on to you, and pass that teaching on to others who will pass it on to others. The authentic teachers of the church are the apostles of Jesus Christ. They are the foundation of the church. There aren't any apostles today, at least not in the sense that there were in the New Testament. So how do we continue in the teaching of the apostles today? Well, the New Testament writings go back to the apostles. They were written by apostles or by co-workers with the apostles, people like Luke and Mark. So we continue in the teaching by continuing in the New Testament, by continuing in God's Word. So familiarize yourself with the teaching, with the gospel, with the New Testament. And most churches have summarized what they believe to be the teaching of the New Testament in creeds and confessions and catechisms and bases of faith. And these are important. You need to get to know them. And John says, don't run ahead. Don't think you can leave the apostles behind. You can't leave the apostles behind. Don't try and run ahead. Don't try and be avant-garde. If you think you've discovered something that the apostles missed, you're wrong. Okay? It's as simple as that. So continue in the teaching. And then secondly, the second point he makes is in verses 10 and 11, and basically we can summarize it like this: give deceivers no support or encouragement. Give deceivers no support or encouragement. Verse 10, if anyone comes to you and doesn't bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked work. Don't encourage false teachers. If you do, you share in their wicked work. Now, when we read verses 10 and 11, did anybody here think, well, that's a bit negative, isn't it? That's a bit unloving, isn't it? Don't take him into your house or welcome him. Unloving, negative? Can I remind you what John wrote in verses 5 and 6? I'm not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. One of the great emphases of John is that Christians love one another. He says in 1 John, if you don't love your brother, you're not born of God. You don't know God, because God is love. This is his great emphasis. And yet here he says, if one of these false teachers comes along, don't welcome him into your home. Don't take him into your house. Or welcome him. If you do, you'll be sharing in his wicked work. So what he's writing there can't be contrary to Christian love. In fact, it must be an expression of true Christian love. Is it loving for a sheep to let a wolf loose into the fold? Not loving at all. It's the opposite of loving. Now bear in mind that in New Testament times there were lots of itinerant preachers. Bear in mind the churches met in homes. So when he says don't welcome these people into your churches, into your homes, he probably means don't welcome them into your churches. Don't give them any support. Don't recognize their ministry if they're denying the gospel. I don't think he's saying that a clued up church leader couldn't informally meet a deceiver over a cup of coffee and try to persuade him of the truth of the gospel. I don't think he's saying that at all. But he's saying that churches should not formally encourage or welcome people who are teaching, quite deliberately teaching, a false gospel. We shouldn't encourage or support them in any way. Our job is to protect our people from such men, not to encourage them. So that's the third point. Don't expect to be popular if you take this line. There's a bishop in America called Bishop John Spong. John Spong doesn't just disbelieve in the Trinity and the Incarnation. He doesn't believe in the virgin birth. He doesn't believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Of course, he favours the ordination of practicing homosexuals into the ministry of the Church of England, into the Episcopal Church of America. And our local Churches Together group in Kendal invited John Spong to Kendal to come and speak and share his view. We as a church therefore decided not to be part of Churches Together in Kendal. I'm not saying you should make that decision here. I don't know anything about Churches Together in Carlisle. It might be totally different. But, and especially also when we found out that the Unitarians at that time certainly were in Churches Together in Kendal who don't believe in the Trinity, we decided not to belong to the Churches Together in Kendal. Don't expect to be popular. I was walking, minding my own business, contemplating the meaning of life, the universe and everything like you do. I was walking along the high street of Kendal shortly after we made that decision, and a nice old lady from the Salvation Army came walking up, and she glared at me and she said, "Christians not together in Kendal, not good, not good." I actually thought she was going to hit me with a handbag. That's the decision we made. Don't give people who deny the bodily resurrection of Jesus or the deity of Christ or the doctrine of justification by faith any support or any encouragement whatsoever. Do not pay them a stipend, for instance. And my final point is two important distinctions I want you to make. I'm sorry I've gone slightly over, but I didn't start till about nearly 4:15, did I?
No.
So, am I all right? I want to make two important distinctions here, and I do want you to hear this, both of them. I want you to distinguish, first of all, between ordinary Christians who've been led astray and who are mixed up and leaders or teachers who are formally, deliberately preaching false doctrine. That's an important distinction to make. Spend time with Christians who have been mixed up. Try and sort them out. We're talking here about official leaders and teachers who are teaching what is contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's an important distinction to make. And the other important distinction is that we must distinguish between serious false teaching about matters that affect salvation and comparatively secondary differences of opinion about matters that don't affect our salvation at all. You don't have to separate from everybody who disagrees with you. Please. I mean, there are people who seem to be temperamentally attracted to passages like this. And they love separating for as many people as possible. I've had people who want to separate from me because my views about exactly what's going to happen in the last days have been slightly different from theirs, or my view of Israel has been slightly different, well, quite a lot different actually from theirs, or how I interpret Genesis 1 might be slightly different from the way they interpret Genesis 1. Don't separate about things like that. Discuss them like grown-up Christians over a coffee, if you want. Spiritual gifts, church government. Christians have differed over those things for centuries. Bible-believing, godly, evangelical Christians have differed for centuries over those things. You don't have to separate from everybody who disagrees with you. That kind of heresy hunting is as dangerous and as destructive as the toleration of deceivers that John is condemning in this passage. So there we are. I think I'll finish there. Do you take over now, Richard?